We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. The following sermon was given at St. Matthias Family Church, where Philip Jensen was senior minister.
We come as we work our way through the Epistle of James to chapter 5 and verses 7 to 11. And within a couple of weeks we'll be finished this year's endeavour. The passage we come to today is a clear call to patience. Patience is not a normal or natural characteristic of humans. Indeed, rather, impatience is the norm. The small boy waiting for his birthday party, the young family waiting for the advent of their new child, the motorist in a queue, the shopper at the cash register. Impatience is the natural state. Patience is a very unnatural state. By patience I mean the calm endurance under pain or under provocation or under irritation. The perseverance, the waiting for something. There are two Greek words that are translated patience in our passage here. In the modern translations they're differentiated by the word patience and steadfast. So we do not read any more of the patience of Job. We actually read of the steadfastness of Job in this passage. One word is the one of self-restraint, being slow to anger. The other being steadfast, enduring pain, enduring trials and persecutions and difficulties. But we are called to be patient, to be steadfast. And to help us understand what he means by it, James gives us three illustrations. The illustration of a farmer, the prophet, and Job. These three illustrations of James we take in turn. Farmer is in verse 7. I know very little about farming, almost nothing indeed, but even I can work this one out. That he plants and he has to wait. He has to wait for the rains to come. He has to wait for the harvest. He looks forward to the harvest, but there is no way he can speed it up, really. He just has to wait for the plants to come to their maturation. We need, therefore, the patience to look forward. You see, not all patience is a patience which involves endurance of pain and difficulty. The only pain and difficulty involved in there is listening to the news each day to hear how the prices of his crops are going down. But there really isn't much pain and endurance in his waiting. It's just waiting, looking forward to something that's going to be very pleasurable, he hopes. But it involves waiting. The second illustration that's used is that of the prophets in verse 10. Here it's quite different. Suffering is involved. As an example of suffering and patience, brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. The prophets are always engaged in bearing with difficulty as a result of their calling. By and large, the prophets in the Bible have a miserable time as they live their lives out. Each and every one of them go through fairly unhappy times. Be it Moses as he tries to drag that motley mob of grumblers across the desert. Be it Jeremiah as he's lowered down the sewage drains to be kept in prison there for a little while. They all have a fairly rough time as a result of their calling. Stephen, when he is brought before the court in Acts chapter 7, makes as part of his defence the rhetorical question to the Jewish elders. Which of the prophets have not your fathers persecuted? The whole history of Israel is littered with persecuted prophets. Yet, looking back, the true Jew will always see that they are the blessed ones. They are the happy ones, as James says. Behold, we call those happy who were steadfast. See, which little Jewish boy wouldn't grow up thinking, wouldn't it be a wonderful thing to have been Moses? I tell you, it would be the little Jewish boy who didn't live during Moses' period in time, who didn't observe the trial and torment and difficulty that he went through. But because he did go through them, because he was steadfast, So we can look back and say, wasn't he a great one? We can, that actually is true outside just the prophet, isn't it? I mean, that's true of any of the great ones, from Captain Cook to Nelson to whoever you might have as a childhood hero from history. But the ones who turn out to be heroes are the ones not who didn't have suffering, they didn't have an easy life, but the ones who endured through it are considered to be the happy ones. The third illustration he uses is that of Job. You've heard of the steadfastness, the patience of Job. Here is a man in face of terrible trouble, appalling difficulties overtaking. He loses all his family, all his flocks, all his houses, all his children. The only thing that's left to him is his wife, and she's no use to him at all. Here's a man who goes through every conceivable... Wives are of tremendous use to people. Just his wife was a rotter. I presume that's why she was left. All kinds of terrible things, you see, this man goes through. I mean, he sits there in terrible disease with all these boils and scabs over his body, and he's only got old pieces of clay to scrape away at them. And then three friends come along who are the world's worst friends in as far as human history is concerned, and they add to his troubles for 38 solid chapters. There is Job in every possible difficulty, and yet, although in the face of every temptation, he does not curse God and die, like his wife suggests that he should. But rather he continues in real difficulty, in real turmoil, in such difficulty and turmoil that you think he's going to throw in his faith halfway through, and two-thirds of the way through, and three-quarters of the way through. You keep on thinking he's going to lose his faith, but he continues steadfast to the end. Now, I guess that few of us here this morning, if any, have faced the difficulties that Job has faced. I don't see many of us sitting here with our wounds all open, scraping away at them. And I do not know that many of us who have lost our everything as Job did. In fact, Job is that person who has had every difficulty that can conceivably be thought of and has had them all piled up together. I suspect that if we threw all the difficulties of all our lives together, we'd be hard-pressed to equal Job. And I suppose that is what you should think about Job. Here's the man who goes through the extremes. But yes, we all have had difficulties. One of the true things said by Eliphaz, one of Job's less-than-true advisors, is the famous line, "Man is born to trouble as sparks fly upwards." Part of our life here. To be living in difficulty. Sufferings come upon each one of us, be it the sufferings of sickness, or financial stringencies, or family difficulties, or the difficulties of and unhappiness in the lives of our friends, or our own failures, our fears, our anxieties, our depressions. We all, each and every individual person here, has suffered and will suffer. And suffering is never easy to take. It is never easy to tolerate or to endure. For it's of its very nature, suffering is unpleasant. That's what it is about. If it's nothing else, it is always unpleasant. But what adds insult to injury is that it seems to be unfairly apportioned around the world. That some people seem to lead a far more Job-like existence than other people. And as the book of Job rightly points out, those who suffer the most aren't necessarily those who are the guiltiest. But we do not seem to see suffering evenly and justly distributed around the world. What we do tend to see is that we have got more than our own fair share. It's an interesting comment on life, isn't it? That most of us think that in the misfortunes of this life, by the time I've come to the end of it, I've got more than my own fair share, which of course statistically can't be possible, can it? However, there is that tendency to think that way. But that's not the way. Yet there is injustice, isn't there? Are the people of India more sinful than we, that they have to go through the floods and famines they go through? Are the people of Southeast Asia more wicked than we, that they have to have millions of them in refugee camps? So it goes on. Why is it that some would suffer so greatly and others so little? Worse still, when we suffer because of innocence, as in persecution or derision or sneers or dislikes because of a desire to live a godly life. He, of course, is the oppression of which we read about last week in the first few verses, where those who come to their riches so easily will oppress those who are poor. But there's even greater difficulty than that. And that is the friends who are supposed to be the people who support us so often let us down. And that is almost the hardest blow of all. It's one thing to be disliked by one's enemies. You never expected anything different. But to be disliked, distrusted by your friend, by your family, by your Christian family, that is a different thing altogether. That is even harder. Robert Frost, the American writer, said, good fences make good neighbours. That's a terrible cynicism of life, isn't it? But yet it is so true. For while it is easy to love mankind, as Charlie Brown points out, it's so hard to love people. And when you get down to the fact of the person sitting next to you, not necessarily at the moment, but possibly at the moment, I'm safe, so I'm standing. When you get down to the person sitting next to you, it is so much more difficult to love them, and they fail us so frequently because they are thoughtless, indifferent, cold, callous, and so forth. And that is possibly the hardest of all sufferings for us to be going through. But we all will go through them. Now, James encourages us here to be patient. To be patient in the difficulties of life. And he does so on the basis of certain facts that he would remind us of. The first one is the coming of the Lord, which is mentioned in verse 7, 8 and 9. The coming of the Lord. Be patient until the Lord comes. As the farmer waits for the harvest, so we are to wait for Christ, looking forward to that time that lies ahead of us, a great time of blessing that lies ahead. We're to keep our eyes on that, knowing that it's not far off, it's not distant, this coming of the Lord. Here is real encouragement that we're to be patient until the coming of the Lord, because he will come and make all things right. These encouragements are very real and not altered by 2,000 years of lapse. One might be tempted to say, well, that promise that he's coming soon is a long time coming. And it is, in one sense. I've had the privilege of watching all three of my children born. And from that experience of three different hospitals, I've noticed a similarity amongst the nursing staff in their technique. Very great similarity. And one of the chief techniques that they all use is the encouragement of the mother. And the encouragement they use is the certain fact that the baby is going to be born. That is a clear fact at that stage. There's not much doubt that something's happening. And they encourage the mother to hold on the grounds that it won't be long now. Now, I did not hear one nurse ever analyse the amount of time it would take. They never said 2 hours, 35 minutes and 40 seconds. Partly, I presume, because they do not know. But basically because that won't help. What helps is the knowledge that it's coming soon. And on the basis of the knowledge that it's coming soon, they encourage the mother to hold on, or rather to push out, as it may be on that occasion. But it's to encourage the mother, don't worry, it's only a little longer. It's almost over, it's almost there. So although we do not know the date in which Christ is coming, the encouragement comes from the knowledge that he is coming, and coming soon. And when he comes, it's not only in the happiness and joy that he will bring, but also he is coming as the judge. So we read in verse 9, do not grumble, brethren, against one another, that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the doors. The judge is coming. And so the wrongs of this world will not remain forever, but will be put right. The injustices of this world will not remain forever, but will be put right. The oppressed will be liberated, and the oppressors will be oppressed, as the change in the whole world order takes place when the judge comes. And comes he will soon, for he's at the very doors. That's why it's totally inappropriate for us to grumble and judge each other and complain about each other. For that is to pass judgment before the judgment is due. So the first great fact that James encourages us by is the knowledge of the return of the Lord. The second and third come out of the teaching on Job. We know the purposes of the Lord. Verse 11, you have heard the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord. That is, we've seen in Job the purpose of God. That in suffering, God is actually teaching him and leading him and instructing him and developing him so that he would grow in understanding and in relationship and trust in God. That the Job who stands at the end of the book is a much greater man than the one at the beginning. Although the one at the beginning sounds so righteous. Yet Job as a person grows and develops through the suffering and turmoil that he has put through. The world, even Satan in the book of Job, is under God's control, working out God's purposes for Job's good. You may remember back in the first chapter, in the second verse of the Epistle of James, we're taught that we're to count trials all joy, for we know that the testing of our faith produces steadfastness. Steadfastness, having its full effect, will lead us to be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. That is, as with muscles, it is the testing of them, it is the straining of them that builds them up. So it is with faith and trust in God, that the sufferings that we endure are not for the destruction of our faith, but for the maturing of our faith, for its developing. Because the third fact also is involved, namely the Lord's character. I read verse 11 again. You have heard the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purposes of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. He is a merciful and compassionate God. He who is in control of the difficulties we're going through, he who is working his purposes out through the difficulties of life that we're suffering, is the one who can be characterized by being merciful and compassionate. He will work out his plan mercifully and compassionately. Now at the time it may not feel like that. At the time I bet that Job thought of anything but mercy and compassion as being a characteristic of God's dealing with him. Halfway through the suffering, it was agony. It was actually wondering whether God had any heart at all to put me through such a turmoil, such a difficulty, such a tribulation. Yet ultimately, at the end, we can see that it was for his good. But it was an expression of God's mercy and compassion. Thus, as we know the end is soon, and that he who has the end in control is both merciful and compassionate, so we should be patient. To be patient gives me a fairly obvious other illustration, and that is the extension of the word that has now come into our medical language. A patient. Matthew, the eldest of the Jensen tribe from here, went to hospital last week to be a patient. He volunteered, under encouragement from his parents, he volunteered to undertake a certain degree of pain and discomfort because he was assured and knew that there would be an end to the pain. Indeed, he would be better off pain-wise, as a result of undergoing some extra pain. But those regular attacks of tonsillitis, the blocking up of the ears and the rest that were following from it, would be done away with if he would be willing to undertake even a more severe pain for a short period of time. He knew there would be an end to it, and an end which would be better. Secondly, he knew the doctor and had confidence in the doctor, that the doctor really knew what he was doing. That he could remove tonsils, aspirate ears, and do whatever you do to adenoids, but he was confident that the doctor was able to do that which he was being paid to do and which he had promised to do, that the doctor was in control of the circumstances. Thirdly, he knew that the doctor was a benevolent character. So not only was he in control, but he wasn't in control for evil, but for good. But the doctor wasn't a sadist who had operation table joy, but one who really did care to bring about relief for the patient and for the benefit of the patient. Thus he could endure and bear with the difficulties and discomforts of his life for the last week or so. Because he knew there would be an end. He knew the doctor had done the job properly. He knew the doctor was doing a job which was for his good. That's not to say that he didn't need encouragement. That most of the week he needed encouragement. Kept on needing to be reminded of these facts. We kept on needing to encourage him and remind him that it would be over soon. That soon he'd be better. And he wouldn't get tonsillitis anymore. And it would be a lot better now. And there wouldn't be much longer putting up with this pain and difficulty. And yes, we did understand that it was a very terrible thing he was going through. But yet, it would soon be better. Because hadn't the doctor done the deed? And didn't the doctor do it properly? On the basis of those pieces of information, it still hurts. But it's endurable. You still suffer. But you can bear with it in patience. I used to illustrate that same point from dentistry. But as my dentist assures me it's the age of painless dentistry, it's now no longer appropriate that one should illustrate it that way. However, in the old days, before the age of painless dentistry, you might recall that we would volunteer for pain on the grounds of our confidence that the dentist knew what he was doing and he was doing it for our good and that there would be an end to it. The end to the pain and we'd be better off. So we'd actually volunteer to go through suffering, not just have suffering come upon us. So then, we're to be patient. Patient with God. It is very tempting to be angry with God for the difficulties of my life and the problems I'm going through. That's an easy thing to do. It's often easy to point the finger at him rather than facing up to my own responsibility or elsewhere. I visited a man who had a terrible car accident in Manly some years ago. Hardly a bone in his body seemed to be left intact. They assumed he was going to die, but he kept on living. They assumed he had permanent brain damage, but gradually he regained his faculties. Over the months and weeks where I used to visit him so regularly and pray beside his bed, he came to recognise me, and after about 8 months or so started speaking, difficult to understand what he was saying. The first sentence I actually understood that he ever said to me was, "Why did God do this to me?" That is not an easy question to be faced with. All the more difficult when the accident he was in was a car had mowed him down on the road. He was a pedestrian. And the driver was as drunk as could be. Didn't even know he'd done it. Hard to blame God, but there, you could. Even harder to explain, really, when the pedestrian who had been knocked down was even drunker than the driver. He was drunk, the driver was drunk, but it was God's fault. It's so often like that, isn't it? That we will look to anybody to blame other than ourselves for the difficulties of life. But yet you can say, and quite rightly, that sometimes I suffer things that really seemingly out of my control, nothing to do with me. That's right. That is the case. But I shouldn't be blaming the doctor for the pain that is there to improve my health. I shouldn't be blaming God. For God is working his purposes out in this difficult situation. I need to be patient for him, like a farmer waiting for the crops. And with others, I need to be patient. So easy to see everybody else's fault, and not to see my own. To grumble and complain and murmur against everybody else for letting me down, while hoping that they will be patient with me when I fail them. Hoping that they will overlook my little foibles and difficult characteristics. We must be patient with each other. We are not the judge. The judge is at the door. He will fix it up. Just be patient. And likewise with myself. I must establish my heart. Verse 8. You also be patient. Establish your hearts for the coming of the day of the Lord. The rich have fattened their hearts for that day, ready for the judgment. But for those of us who are looking for the return of the Lord, we are to establish ourselves in righteousness and holiness, eagerly looking for that day when he will return and give to us those things which he has already won for us on the cross of Calvary. So we're to prepare our hearts, not of course our organ at this point, the blood pump, but our own selves for Christ's return, looking eagerly for it as we seek to live in accordance with his ways. That is the way of being patient, here and now, establishing ourselves so that when he does come, we'll be ready for him, whenever that may be, prepared, for we've been so eagerly looking for him to return.
Let us continue our service, shall we, by singing the next hymn. I'll mention three announcements while Jenny is getting there. She's there, but I'll mention them anyway. One is for any visitors amongst us to welcome you, of course, to morning tea straight after our service, which we serve here in the building. Please feel free to share with us at tea or coffee. Secondly, is that on the notice sheet there is a small alteration, not an error, it's an alteration we'd like to make. That is that the midweek prayer, a Bible study, is starting on Wednesday nights, not Tuesday nights. Same address, same time, but it's Wednesday nights. Thirdly, immediately after this hymn, we'll baptise Rachel. And on your notice sheets, I think it's on the back page, where the hymns and the rest are listed, you'll find there's a prayer, and at one point in the service, the congregation is to join in a prayer together, and it is that prayer. So that once the service gets underway, if you'd hold that sheet ready, you'll come to that prayer fairly quickly.
We'll sing our next hymn, which is a baptismal hymn number 339.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.